Thanks for listening to Star Lores. If you like the show, please consider subscribing and giving a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also help us make more great content by becoming a patron at www.patreon.com. We would also love to hear from you on social media. You can follow Star Lores on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Enjoy the show, and may the Force be with you.
You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Are you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder?
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
Xenoanthropology. With around 20 million sentient species consisting of trillions of individuals, the galaxy teems with distinct social groups to study. These groups form cultures defined as the customs, arts, social institutions, and achievements of a particular nation, people, or other social group. The data collection and analysis of a single culture can and does take many lifetimes of dedicated study. There will be no pretense here of establishing a complete catalog of the near countless cultures that exist or have existed throughout the galaxy. Elder races, those which date from before approximately 30,000 BBY, like the Celestials, Rakata, Gree, Sharu, and Kilix, are studied by Xenoarchaeology. As an academic discipline, Xenoanthropology makes every attempt to come to objective, empirically derived conclusions. Most experts in the field acknowledge that there is a fundamental difficulty in doing this, as culture itself is a subjective lens through which all beings, anthropologists included, see the galaxy. A grain of salt must therefore always be digested, provided sodium chloride is non-toxic to your biology, with the data explored here. The theoretical aspect of cultural anthropology is in itself a rich field, but beyond the bounds of our discussion. The word xenoanthropology comes from a dead human language, similar to Galactic Standard Basic. In this tongue, anthropos is thought to literally mean humans, and xenos means foreign. Therefore, xenoanthropology means the study of foreign humans. For our purposes, xenoanthropology refers to the study of any culture of sentient beings. This term is only one of the many ways that human thought has influenced the galactic community. A final etymological note is that the term anthropoid means human-like, here meaning bipedal, possessing two or more upper limbs, with hands, a head, forward-facing vision, and a central nervous system. This discussion will therefore focus mostly on beings meeting these broad biological standards, while acknowledging the fact that sentience and culture are not restricted to anthropoid body forms. Galactic community.
Galactic community refers to a kind of metaculture which subsumes all groups that have regular contact and interconnections with one another in the galaxy far, far away. The subcultures that make up the galactic community are frequently characterized by political bodies consisting of single species, though not necessarily. Subcultures frequently form galactic states which are porous and malleable, rising, falling, and fusing with other groups across time. There are important exceptions to the single species subculture pattern. As an example, the nomadic Mandalorians eventually become a multi-species society, the founding members of which, the Tong, went extinct. The cosmopolitan Mandalorians continued for millennia after this, accepting any being into their culture who swore loyalty to their principles. Another exception are the Hutts, who settled on Nalhutta after their homeworld, Varl, was rendered uninhabitable. Once established and part of the galactic community, the Hutts incorporated Weequay, Gamorrean, Klaatunian, and Nikto cultures into their various Kaijidaks. Humans also lie outside of the single-species subculture pattern. There are many culturally distinct human groups, of a diversity not seen in other species. Humans show a willingness to integrate, appropriate, cooperate, and sometimes conquer their local cultural milieu, regardless of the genetics of their neighbors. For example, despite an ancient enmity between human and Tong groups, humans eventually became one of the majority species of the Neo-Mandalorian society. Since the charting of the major hyperlanes and the formation of the Old Republic, circa 25,000 BBY, the galactic community has remained quite stable, at least on the cosmological scale, i.e. over tens of millennia. Prior to this, the galactic community is thought to have been conceived and regulated by the mythological celestials for an unknown period of time.
My people are most commonly thought of as spies and assassins, able to disguise themselves and blend in with any group of sentience.
Quote, Mamun Hul. The Xiaidu scholar Mamun Hul is probably the most widely known and referenced xenoanthropologist, and his work is studied and respected across the galaxy. His landmark book, The Essential Guide to Species, has even been distributed in some form to the Milky Way galaxy, a distance of at least 2 million light years, as well as being standard reading for xenoanthropologists and biologists. Since much of the highest quality primary research for xenoanthropological data comes from the esteemed Professor Hul, our story of xenoanthropology will begin with his culture, the Xiaidu of Laomon, in the unknown regions. This region of space gets its name due to being largely unexplored by the galactic community and contains roughly 15% of the galaxy's mass. Hyperspace anomalies have traditionally prevented much travel and cultural interchange between groups in the unknown regions and the rest of the galaxy. This is the region of space that is off the map, a place of myth, speculation, and fear to the galactic community. As a species, the Xiaidu are capable of transforming their body's structure and appearance, which they call skin shifting. An experienced Xiaidu can pass as virtually any anthropoid being, as well as inanimate object. Xiaidu also have a form of telepathy that can project perceptions into the brain of the aliens they mimic, compensating for any inconsistencies their shape-shifted form may have. Because of these incredible abilities, the mysterious Xiaidu are known across the galaxy as assassins and spies, and are often not trusted by outsiders. Those abilities, which could make them excel at more nefarious professions, also make them particularly suited to xenoanthropology. It is in fact the latter, and similar academic fields to which most Xiaidu are attracted. While studying alien cultures, many researchers have difficulty collecting data in such a way that does not alter the subject of their study. They cannot observe subjects in the wild because their presence disrupts that wild. To facilitate an unadulterated research sample, anthropologists often use informants, who are members of the group they are studying, but can collect data surreptitiously. This practice, while better than tainting the data, has its own complications. as informants typically need to be trained in ad hoc methodology and lack the academic rigor of principal investigators. Anthropologists sometimes make efforts to establish rapport and integrate themselves into the culture of study. After time, their presence within the group becomes theoretically unobstructive. They can then begin the bulk of their research. In this time and resource-intensive process, however, anthropologists sometimes go native to varying degrees. That is, they consider themselves a part of the group of study, which then casts a shadow of doubt over any research they do, as they have lost their sense of objectivity. In the most extreme examples, researchers may abandon their investigations entirely, or to the extent that they complete projects, may deeply offend their research subjects. Furthermore, in the case of xenoanthropology, researchers are usually of a different species than their research subjects, which makes the above process even more difficult, if not impossible. Additionally, the problem of informants telling researchers what they want to hear is persistent and difficult to detect. If an anthropologist is able to blend in the way that only a Shiadu is capable of, then they can safely, quickly, and frugally observe their subjects without above complications. The Shiadu, who is skilled in skin shifting, is also likely much better at perspective taking, as they can gain an unprecedented level of experiential knowledge by assuming different physical identities. There is an ethical issue with this practice, however, as research done in this manner is perhaps done without obtaining the informed consent of research subjects. A second factor, which has led to Shiadu academic excellence, is their incredibly long lives. With an average lifespan of approximately 500 years, and often insatiable curiosity, they're capable of learning and disseminating far more knowledge about the universe than most beings. Despite their love of knowledge, the Shiadu culture at large are reluctant to have much contact or exchange with the galactic community. Though there are a number of gregarious individual Shiadu. Professor Huul and his friend, Shi Shun, for example, both studied at the Chandrilan Academy of Sciences, thousands of light years away from Lao Mun. After graduating, they were employed by the Galactic Republic to study biowarfare during the Clone Wars, and worked for the Empire afterwards. During the Galactic Civil War, Professor Huul applied his knowledge of alien cultures when he adopted the human children of his deceased friends, the Arandas. It was during this time that Huul traveled the galaxy and compiled notes that would eventually become the essential guide. Jedi.
For over a thousand generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic. Before the Dark Times. Before the Empire.
The deep core world of Tython is the grandfather planet of the Jedi Order. Eight megalithic pyramidal ships called Thoyor landed on worlds inhabited by pre-hyperspace cultures, collected pilgrims of various species, and brought them to Tython. The landing site of each Thoyor subsequently became cornerstones of Jedi culture. Each landed Thoyor served as a temple devoted to a particular interpretive aspect of the Force. An ancient Qua holocron contains additional references to the Thoyor, but its contents have not been widely recorded. Despite their devotion to balance, the Jedi could not keep their society from collapsing, and a civil war eventually erupted, devastating the Order. By this time, the Jedi had gained hyperspace technology and relocated to Ossus in 25,000 BBY at the conclusion of the war. It was on Ossus that they reformed Jedi doctrine and changed their name to the Jedi Order. The most significant schism between Jedi and Jedi teachings is that the Jedi believed that the only the light side of the Force is acceptable to study and use, perhaps a reaction to the war on Titan. There are proscriptions against the nebulous concept of alchemy linked to the dark side in the Order's early doctrine. These dogma have been the cause of much strife throughout the Jedi Order's lifespan. Ossus had more direct connections to the major stable hyperspace routes, and so the Jedi Order went from a planetary to a galactic organization in a brief period of time. Shortly after establishing their Ossus Temple, the Jedi became deeply involved in the affairs of the fledgling Galactic Republic, and thus the Galactic Community, and that relationship has remained constant over the millennia. Galactic Republics.
I love democracy. I love the Republic.
Senator Palpatine, 22 BBY.
These are the largest subcultures in the Galactic Community, and consist of human majority as well as thousands of alien species. Therefore, galactic republics can be considered human cultures. It is not known which core world humans and the cultural traditions of which underpin the republic originated, but Coruscant is generally considered their homeworld. Human societies differ from one another so much that there is no single typical example of human culture. Galactic republics, perhaps cast in the mold of their human majority, incorporate a huge variety of races and groups, and tend to dominate the galactic community. Since mastering hyperspace technology, humans have gone on to become the most numerous and widely distributed sentient species in the galaxy. Prior to hyperdrives, humans were so curious and adventurous that they had accomplished the interminable task of colonizing multiple star systems, like Corellia and Alderaan, with sub-hyperspace technology. Circa 25,000 BBY, the intrepid core-dwelling humans reverse-engineered the hyperspace technology of an elder race. From then on, they boldly went where none had gone before, settling new worlds and establishing trade and cultural exchanges with other civilizations. There is evidence that humans displaced another Coruscanti sentience, the Tong, after centuries of warfare. Despite having many pro-social characteristics, a tendency toward war, conquest, and genocide seems to be one of the oldest traits of human cultures. This is not to say that other species are free of such violent tendencies, as the Hutt cataclysms and indeed the Tong can attest. The ripples of that first conflict on Coruscant would affect the evolution of the galactic community for millennia to come. From the deep core to wild space, from the Jedi Order to the Order of the Sith Lords, hardly a single being has escaped the burning embers of weaponized volcanoes used by the ancient humans to decimate and drive the Tong off-world. Values frequently identified by members of the first and most subsequent galactic republics include egalitarianism, mutual benefit of member worlds, peace, democracy, self-determination, material prosperity, and cultural advancement. Other synonymous organizations include the Alliance of Free Planets and the Galactic Alliance. The ubiquity, number, and apparent cultural dominance of humans in the Republic and the galaxy has led to tensions between them and other species. These are exemplified in the extreme by terrorist organizations like the Diversity Alliance, which advocated genocide through bioweapons. In the case of republics, xenophobia is generally frowned upon, and multiculturalism is encouraged, though their history is replete with exceptions.
Hutts. As ancient and generally as stable, if not more so, as the Republic, is the culture of the Hutt species. Their society has no proper name which unites them, and Hutt culture is referred to variously as Empire, Cartels, Kaijedics, and Huttspace. Like the Republic, Hutt society encompasses a huge diversity of species. The contrast between these societies lies in their hierarchies. Within their society, there are a few non-Hutts who possess substantial wealth, power, and esteem. Although just as diverse, in its sentient species as Republic space, Hutt space is dominated by one species, the Hutts. Though few in number, this culture holds an enormous proportion of economic and military resources in the galactic community. Early in their history, Hutts had a strong warrior society and were characterized by internal violence. Like many species before 30,000 BBY, they were a vassal race to the Rakatan Infinite Empire, but eventually overthrew their masters and appropriated Rakatan technology. The Hutts then went on to perform expansionist empires of their own. Due to maximum recorded lifetimes in excess of a millennia, Hutts have ample time to accumulate wealth, knowledge, and extensive criminal and legitimate business networks. They also have a unique nervous system in which multiple brains are known to sometimes grow, maximizing their intellectual capacity and ability for lateral information processing. This nervous system is also resistant to the effects of the Force, further inoculating Hutt society against outside influence. They cared little for the opinions of outsiders, considering them to be slanderous and envious of Hutt power. Hutts were extremely competitive with one another, to the point of extreme paranoia, which may be a throwback to Hutt society as it was on Varl when they had higher levels of interspecies violence. It is said Hutts experience threat on some subconscious, intuitive, or instinctual level. To call this suspicion paranoia is perhaps a misnomer, as their Hutt friends and family often are spying and plotting against them. Sith Empires.
This manuscript could have undue influence, especially among the vulnerable and easily persuaded students who will be subjected to Professor Ellis's disturbing viewpoints.
Compnor official Bront Auten, circa 10 BBY.
The post-racial Sith first entered the galactic community in 5000 BBY, when they started the Great Hyperspace War, a conflict of retaliation for ancient grievances against the Jedi. Since this time, the Sith have endured as an often maligned subculture in the galactic community, despite apparently disappearing at various times. Much of the codified values of the Sith can be seen as a reaction to the restrictive codes of their Jedi progenitors. In general, the moral philosophy followed by many Sith places them at the zenith of sentience and galactic domination as their right. On the other hand, they are extremely secretive and value deception highly. Therefore, externally valid data about them is difficult to obtain. Further cementing a certain amount of confusion about this group is the tendency for learned and powerful Sith to jealously guard their knowledge until they are murdered by one of their own students. Though certain Sith endorse various forms of anthropocentrism and naked racism, this is not necessarily a defining characteristic. Like the Jedi, there have been Sith from almost every sentient species in the galaxy. They sometimes practice social and political philosophies that bear startling similarities to eugenics, believing that anybody too weak to defend themselves deserves death, often at the hands of the Sith. Others are devoted to the expression of a single emotion, such as pain, fear, or misanthropy. Such individuals often harm others in their pursuit of greater expressions of these negative emotions. The praxis of Sith philosophy seems to inevitably lead to violence and war, but to say that there is a monolithic doctrine of the Sith is less accurate than the same about an organization like the Jedi. It is this praxis, however, that has earned the Sith an enduring and mostly accurate personification as sadistic, nihilistic butchers and mad wizards. The first Sith Empire absorbed many of the characteristics of the Sith species. The second Sith Empire was less about religion and ceremony and devoted mostly to galactic domination, utilizing ancient Rakatan technology. A third incarnation of Sith Empire lasted until the Second Galactic Civil War. In another series of conflicts, Darth Bane came to prominence, and the changes he instituted to Sith traditions would change them and the galaxy forever. With the deaths of Sidious and Vader, the Baneite tradition ended, and the secret society became more fractious and obtuse than ever. There was a brief moment of unity in the Sith culture from 127 to 130 ABY with Darth Krayt's One Sith philosophy. But this too descended into a bloodbath, and by 130 ABY, the Order was believed to be extinct again. The Galactic Empire was the product of generations of Sith plotting, and was ruled by powerful Sith lords, though they suppressed knowledge of their identity. During this time, the Empire took a surprising interest in Zetoanthropology, and notable discoveries were made by Aitikian anthropologists about the origins of life and civilization in the Dantooine system. A young spacer named Lando Calrissian also made significant, if convoluted, discoveries about the Sharu race during the Empire's reign. It came to light that the enslaved Sharu people had been engaging in a cultural practice aimed at reducing their sentience, supposedly to avoid the notice of an ancient threat. Entrepreneuring businessmen of low morals for generations took advantage of this practice and easily enslaved the Sharu, until Calrissian's involvement. Among other discoveries, Captain Calrissian learned the effects of some hyper-advanced Sharu technology that could alter the known laws of physics. Darth Vader personally sponsored the Catalog of Intelligent Life in the Galaxy, a textbook similar to Mammon Hull's Essential Guide to Species. The former made claims that were of a less scientific nature than the latter, however, such as that the Mon Calamari and Calami were recently discovered by the Empire, or that Wookiees were non-sentient, a stance the Empire used to justify slavery. An even more overt example of Imperial suppression was the attempted arrest of Tem Ellis, a sentientologist who wrote The University of Sanbra, Guide to Intelligent Life. When the Committee for the Preservation of the New Order, COMPNOR, reviewed the book, they found its pro-alien stance to be in conflict with Imperial philosophy, and pursued the professor, who escaped arrest, becoming a fugitive. Despite being illegal, Ellis distributed the book clandestinely through the HoloNet. Despite individual Sith not typically granting structured interviews to xenoanthropologists, a great deal of their oral history and spiritual traditions are preserved by their holocrons. Since these devices will not function unless a user is attuned to and skilled with the dark side of the Force, these complex devices frustrate scholars. Sith holocron contents are usually only known through second- or third-hand reports from Sith, who are often unreliable narrators. Sith holocrons are a significant part of their material culture. It is interesting that in the broad study of material culture, important religious objects are often given a high degree of subjective valence that borders on sentience. In the case of Sith holocrons, that sentience is quite literal and objective. Through a series of arcane rituals that mix technology, psychology, and the Force, Sith holocron authors imbue their devices with their dark side essence, as well as their neural imprints. This process results in the creation of a gatekeeper, a being or consciousness similar in some respects to force ghosts that can even interact with the physical universe in certain circumstances. Authoring holocrons for the Sith was extremely complicated and required an artisan of great expertise and depth of knowledge about dark side ritual practices. Like many aspects of the Sith, their holocrons contrast those built by the Jedi. While Jedi holocrons are usually cubes that radiate warm blue light with surfaces adorned in simple brass-colored relief patterns, the pyramidal Sith models glow a malevolent shade of red. Both versions can usually fit in the palm of an anthropoid hand, but Sith holocrons are often covered in highly ornate engravings, pictographs, and incantations in the Sith language. At least one Sith holocron has been discovered with the script of an extragalactic language inscribed on it. Jedi holocrons contain an interactive, though relatively simple, AI and hologram that guides a user through its contents. The holo projection would limit access to its content if the student was not considered qualified to learn it. By contrast, Sith holocrons would usually completely divulge their contents to anybody who accessed them, even if this knowledge could harm the user.
Mandalorians.
On the harsh planet Zell, ancient Coruscant, the Tong species developed a strict honor-based warrior society. After losing a war on Zell to their human neighbors, the Tong settled on the planet and moons of Mandalore, which they named after Mandalore the First, their mythic founder. After settling on Mandalore, the Tong referred to themselves as the Mandoaid, or Mandalorians, the sons and daughters of Mandalore, their warrior king. Notable Mandalores include the Indomitable, who allowed non-Tongs into his armies, and the Ultimate, who instigated the Mandalorian Wars. This later conflict is considered to be the extinction event for the Tong species. Since re-emerging in about 4000 BBY, the Mandalorians have both nearly destroyed and virtually saved various galactic republics and similar organizations. Whether as the military bulk of Sith forces in the Great Sith War, or as an ally to Revan in the Jedi Civil War, or Boba Fett training pivotal Jedi, the fate of the galactic community and its republics often rests on the shoulders of the fearsome Mandalorians. Mandalorians value strength, conquest, and conflict, rather than peace and coexistence. In their religious tradition, warfare is considered to be a holy act. Therefore, to war is to be divine. These beliefs are themselves an elaboration of the worship of the war god Cad Harengar by the Tong. Further remnants of Tong civilization are found in the Mandoaid language, still spoken by cultural Mandalorians, and a version of the Da Werda Verda chant taught to clone troopers. Mandalorians are now largely human, but historically included a diverse cross-section of species that adhered to and adopted the Mandalorian culture. The first non-Tong Mandalorians came from a species they warred with, but were impressed by. In later conflicts, like the Mandalorian Wars, they resorted to open recruitment. Modern Mando-Ad culture, like its Tong progenitor, is nomadic and organized into tribal structures. The symbol which unites the tribes is the skull of the ancient Mythosaur, the first of many species to lose a war of existence against Mandalore's children. Mandalorian armor is the best known aspect of the material culture in the wider galaxy. Known as Beskar Ga, the Mandoa, it is considered to be a kind of second skin which unites all Mandalorians, regardless of their ethnic background. Like the Mandalorians themselves, their armor came in many shapes and forms throughout history. The legendary armor forged from Beskar steel could even withstand lightsaber strikes. Mandalorian culture is not a monolith, and has various sub-factions that have evolved over time and have been brought into conflict with one another at times. Despite their once galaxy-shaping past, Mandalorians have since slid into isolationism and become insular towards galactic events, although wherever there is war, a Mandalorian may be lurking in the smoke of its flames.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Tired of desperately trying to retain staff who quit every time your organization causes a mass extinction event? Sick of maintaining the pretense of morality to your workers by offering benefits and competitive wages? Try Zerka Recruiter, the HoloNet service which connects employers with our pool of lifetime contract workers. Using Zerka Recruiter is easy and intuitive. Just tell the AI core what kind of role you need filled, and you will be provided with a holographic menu of contracts to purchase. Using the interface is easy and intuitive. From Ithorian botanists to Nikto Morgukai assassins, Zerka Recruiter has you covered. All Zerka lifetime contracts are guaranteed for the average natural lifespan of the species to whom the contract applies. If a contract worker does not fulfill the owner of the contract stipulations, Zerka Recruiter will replace the contracted worker with the most similar possible contracted worker, free of charge. Zerka Corporation is not liable for damages incurred by worker revolts, strikes, walkouts, blood feuds, vengeance, industrial espionage, and or terrorism, or medical costs after the purchase of a worker's contract.
Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. We are here on the Hydean Way talking about xenoanthropology.
Howdy, Jordan here.
And this is Christian.
And I'm Sam. So, I didn't cover a lot of sort of past 10 ABY in terms of the anthropology, and there's still lots of Star Wars stories past then up until it's 130 ABY is like roughly when Legacies ends. So I know you've read Legacies, but I haven't. So how much does like the culture change in an appreciable way? Because when you look at Star Wars as a whole, when you go back to like, it's really been about the same for like 20,000 years. Or maybe 12,000 years since the Republic, right? But since the Rakatan,
have kind of like the pre-Republic era, which have these other civilizations like the Kwa, the Rakata,
right,
and such. And then it evolved into the Republic era, which covers like a majority of galactic history and the various Sith empires.
But like, unless you're a super Star Wars nerd, if you dropped a person in like the Knights of the Old Republic games versus in the middle of A New Hope, they wouldn't really see much of a difference in terms of like cultures, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they look pretty much the same.
Yeah,
culture, technology.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the one big thing with the aesthetic of Star Wars that doesn't change much for a vast majority of it. We kind of touched a little bit on it in Dawn of the Jedi review. In Star Wars Legacies that you were asking about, I would say there's a big shift, and yet there's such a familiarity that remains.
Like, it rhymes.
Yeah. I don't want to delve too much into it because I kind of want to.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil too much.
Exactly. But without getting too spoiler heavy, the Empire is cast in a very different light.
Right.
They kind of fuse with the Republic.
Yeah, I know. I think it's so the Treaty of Pelion.
Yes, that causes them to.
And an interesting thing that a standard normal person viewing of Star Wars might not understand is that the Galactic Civil War, that's the conflict that's going on through the original trilogy, doesn't actually end until like 40 years later, after the Battle of Endor, when
you have the Imperial Remnant,
when they finally sign a peace treaty, and then, as you say, sort of combine with the Republic.
Yeah, and so the Empire still even exists into that era,
right
in a different form, and again they're cast in a more positive light in the future, but yet being a galactic empire, still using stormtroopers, even TIE fighters. They look different, but the same aesthetic, I guess you could say, goes across them.
There's like those new stealth XS fighters or something.
I don't know what they're actually called.
But they're like the special Jedi fighters.
In what?
I think I'm talking out of my
brain.
My brain.
Yeah, I don't know the details. Okay. It's been a long time since I read Legacies. But yes, there's a lot that's still familiar. You have the Sith coming back. You know, so in terms of culture, I would say they remain very familiar.
Are the huts still a big thing?
I don't recall.
Maybe they're just not even covered necessarily.
Maybe not. Although Cade spends a lot of time in the underworld.
So right.
That very well could be the case. I really don't remember.
So switching away from things that we don't know anything about, which is a lot. Mammon Hool, who, I could have written a whole episode on him.
He may have his own episode in the future.
He's a really fun character, both because he's a shapeshifter, which is kind of awesome. And the fact that the Galaxy of Fear young adult novels, which were an important part of my childhood, getting those from the library back on paper books.
It was like Star Wars Goosebumps.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what it was. It was Star Wars Goosebumps. And so Mamon Hul adopted the Arandes twins, Zach and I can't remember the other one's name. And there's about 10 of the Galaxy of Fear novels, and it's just Mamon Hul and these kids constantly giving him a headache while he's trying to write his notes about the galaxy. He also did an extensive, I think it would be called, they didn't use this language that I could see, but sounded like an ethnography of Tatooine. That was one of the first places Mamon Hul sort of studied as an anthropologist. But even anthropology was kind of his second career. He was really more of a biologist, not a botanist.
I want to be a botanist on Tatooine.
That would be tough.
He did, however, have a very beautiful garden.
So his first career, as I said, he was kind of a bad person. He made bioweapons for first the Republic, but then even after the Republic turned into the Empire, he still worked for them and was still making bioweapons for them. And there's a character called Trioculus, which is like a clone of Palpatine or something like that. I forget the details. Unsurprisingly, he has three eyes.
A name like that?
And so that's pretty cool. And there are also a few other Shi'ido characters that I didn't mention, but Shi'ido characters, when they pop up, do seem to be, a lot of times, they're like scientists and anthropologists and stuff, and they're not really fighters.
Right.
Unlike the Claudites, like we were talking about before.
Or the other shapeshifters in Star Wars.
They're another shapeshifter. Yeah. They're known as being spies and assassins, and that's totally accurate, because they are.
Yeah, like people like Zamwizel come to mind as an example of a Claudite that people are familiar with.
People are just afraid that the Shi'ido are that. But part of that is because Lao Mon is in the Unknown Regions.
Right, which already has a lot of
myth and legends and probably xenophobia, just because it's unknown.
Unknown,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
Anything you don't know about, you're scared of.
Yeah.
And then also the Unknown Regions sort of brings up, and we keep dancing around the Celestials. Eventually we'll do a whole episode on them.
It's going to be a whole thing to unpack.
But part of the reason that the Unknown Regions are unknown is because of the Celestials. They created these big hyperspace anomalies, which I'm not super clear on the details, but it just prevents you from charting safe hyperspace routes to that region. There's only like a very select few, and even those are kind of dangerous. That being said, Lao Mon seems to be pretty advanced, and they don't have too much trouble coming into the other 80% of the galaxy where we find our galactic community. And as of the New Republic, they decided not to become members of the New Republic for sort of unknown reasons. They're not like unfriendly, but
they're not hostile, but they also just want to do their own thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I'm just guessing at this is that, one, they've already developed so much as an independent species because of their isolation. Like, why do they need to?
Yeah, and their long lives, too. Like, I got to think that having 500-year lifespans would create a very different kind of society than what we see on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. And then
a more stable one as well,
yeah,
right?
Because people live for so long. And the other thing, and especially if they're exposed to the wider galaxy, like, you guys are always at war.
Yeah,
why are you guys always constantly
blowing each other up?
Yeah, we want no part of it. And the other thing, too, is like, because they live in such an unstable region, they probably developed their own technology independently of the rest of the galaxy.
Well,
maybe.
I would say it was probably a product of celestial reverse engineering.
Or that. Yeah, either or. But either.
This is one of the details I keep forgetting. I think maybe one or two species independently developed hyperdrive technology, but it's pretty much all comes from reverse engineered celestial technology, which was essentially reverse engineered bootstrapped Rakatan technology, because the Rakatans just straight up revolted and maybe killed the Celestials. But again, that's a
story for another time.
Story for another time, yes. Which is the story of our show.
Yes. And there's going to be a lot of that just moving forward, because, I mean, Star Wars is so many rabbit trails and like goes into so many different spider webs. That being said, though, in the future, we do plan to revisit a lot of the ancient species that we didn't talk about, whose cultural impacts didn't necessarily last as long in terms of like the galactic milieu that we're familiar with.
Right.
So things like the Rakatan Empire and things like that, and the Kwa, like, they're really shadows, you know?
Yeah, they're not, at least I haven't come across a whole lot of material that fleshes them out independent of the Celestials.
Because right. they were all own story in their own era.
Yeah, exactly. They were all also vassal races to the Celestials.
So eventually we'll unpack all that, but we really wanted to touch on the species and races that one had like the longer impact, or at least the impact that we as fans or as the general Star Wars community are most familiar with first. But we will eventually go back and revisit those things. Not to say that like the Jedi and the Sith, the Republic, the Mandalorians all have ancient roots and really have lasted like just as long, if not longer, than a lot of the previous civilizations as well.
And I think this probably comes through in the writing of these episodes. The Sith are, and their sort of evolution is just sort of endlessly fascinating to me. All the strange twists and turns and dives into obscurity and then emergence as a galactic force.
Yeah.
Like out of nowhere.
And then they have like these different wings and different interpretations. And
yeah.
Well, it's even interesting because the Sith, the origins is from a species.
Yeah.
And then it changes to like
an ideology.
An ideology and an empire.
Yeah.
And then it changes to like where it's just for dark Jedis, basically, are the only Siths, right? So to see that change from a species all the way to like the zero ABY.
And then like how the Sith first got there too is they weren't necessarily trying to be Sith, because as we said, that came later. That was after they were exiled by the Jedi and after the first great schism, if I'm not mistaken.
That or the Force Wars, I can't remember which.
But yeah, one of those.
Unless they're the same.
But thing. They were outlawed essentially for their scientific exploration. I can't comment about how moral or immoral it was. I don't know those details, but the Jedi were certainly not happy. But that was the main thrust of them, though, was just sort of experimenting with immortality. That was the extent of their philosophy and their ethics, was just, we want to live forever by using the Force.
Yeah.
But then they took on a lot of their other cultural traditions, like the sort of eugenic attitude and the might makes right kind of thing, all from the Sith species, who they had independently cultivated their own Force practices. And they were like very steeped in esoteric. That was just our R2 unit telling us there's an asteroid belt coming up. Somebody's got to go man those laser cannons and blow them out of the space. So as I was saying, the original Sith, they're really steeped in ceremony and magical arcane rituals, and they bear a lot of resemblance to ancient Egypt. And something I was thinking about is it's very similar in a way to almost how like magic is cast in the Bible, whereas, because literally you've got that Egyptian tie-in, right? And then you've got was it Aaron and Moses who have like a magic duel with the Pharaoh's magicians?
Yeah.
And they're both doing magical things. And then one side is the good guys, Aaron and I forget his name. Or was Moses? It just Aaron?
Moses.
And Aaron. Was Moses in the wizard duel, though? I can't remember.
I believe he was a part of that scene.
He was a part of the scene. So there.
So called to the movie. Yeah.
So their use is,
for lack of a better term,
their use is good, but then the more esoteric, advanced, strange use of the Egyptians is bad.
It might be biblical related, but Egypt is often, and I don't know if this is like almost like the romantic view of Egypt that came out a lot in like the
1920s. I will fill this in for you after you finish.
Okay, yeah. But Egypt is often associated with sorcery and things like that, and has ties to magic. Even in other, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Mythological interpretations. Like, if you read Conan the Barbarian, the analogs to the Egyptians are always known as being, like, magical and things. In Warhammer 40K, they often associated with magic. So
the Necrons.
The story of the mummy, even in, like, our modern cultural context, is tied to, like, Egyptian magic.
Yeah. But so in sort of the early 20th century, occult renaissance that was going on with like Madame Helena Blavatsky. I don't know if you've ever heard of her, but she sort of gives rise to guys like Aleister Crowley, who give rise to guys like Anton LaVey.
Essentially the occult.
People like Blavatsky and Aleister Crowley especially, he did a lot of magical work in square quotes, actually in tombs of Egypt, and sort of believed that he was using Egyptian magics. And then the Freemasons also use a lot of like Egyptian imagery, and part of their mythology is that it goes back to Solomon, and Solomon learned his magic from Egyptians.
Right.
So that's like magic and
it's a common trope.
Egyptian themes.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where it like originates, but it's a common trope outside of Star Wars, but it carries on into Star Wars with the Sith being associated. You know, they build their big tombs and their big temples, and you know, they're very pyramidal.
Exactly.
And even the obsession with immortality is often associated with ancient Egypt, with you know the pharaohs, you know, living forever in the afterlife.
And you see that in the Valley of the Sith King. Lords.
And the Valley of the
Kings. And the Valley of the Kings. They're sort of the same, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you can see those real life cultural
influences,
yes,
we'll say.
Yeah. I was going to say mirrors or something.
Even got like some of the Sith have like crazy headdresses and all sorts of bangles and stuff.
The way they look,
their material culture is very...
Do you want to describe what material culture
material
is?
Material culture. it's been a long time since I took that course, but it's just sort of looking, basically describing everything that happens to objects and how people interact with them and how they take a place in the culture. For example, right now I'm wearing a black leather like motorcycle jacket, and I think most people in the West sort of instantly have a whole bunch of associations that go with that. There's a certain type of person that wears this jacket. A certain type of person likes to wear this jacket. They feel a certain way.
Maybe cultural identity.
There's a cultural identity, several identities attached to it. And it's also sort of divorced from what it initially was, which was like a jacket that pilots used. And then there's...
Yeah, and it would have a functional use and origin.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I mean, I could go into the weeds about materiality. And then I brought this up briefly with the Sith holocrons. And that's where material culture... in the anthropological subdiscipline of material culture gets really interesting and sort of psychedelic and mind-bending for me, is like studying tribes who live in like Papua New Guinea and South Pacific Islanders, and sort of their relationships to objects and people and what you do with bodies after they die and things like that. But also just the idea, there's this deep belief and felt sense among like all members of a tribe, for example, that this particular object, it's not just an object, it has an attitude and feelings and a memory, and it thinks like a holocron, right?
Yeah.
And there's sort of like a ghost attached to various objects. And you can tell how well I remember this course that I took 5 years ago by the fact that I'm using no specifics.
Yeah.
But
keep it as vague as possible.
But that is generally what it is, and that we all sort of do that to a certain extent with our objects. Like we name boats, we name them she, right?
We ascribe, personifications to.
And then you get mad at your car or whatever, and that kind of thing. But
yeah. As if it has a spirit.
So that's what really I really liked about holocrons, and especially the difference between the Jedi and the Sith holocrons, that they're very... Jedi ones are much more simple in like every way, and the Sith ones are like insanely elaborate.
Yeah.
There's also one Jedi holocron that has like a Latin inscription in it, which is further continuity between our galaxy and the Star Wars galaxy.
But hold on, before we get away from the material object thing, there's actually a species in Star Wars that can read telepathically.
Yeah, the Kiffar. Kiffar.
They can...
You know what that ability is called? Psychometry.
Okay, thank you. I was going to say psychokinesis.
Do you know who was briefly a professional psychometrist in this room?
You?
He's got a leather jacket and two thumbs and a big smile on his face.
You're ascribing new feelings towards a leather jacket in our cultural context.
Now, I did not, I could not get psychic projections. The modern day interpretation of psychometry is a little bit different. Just a little bit. But that's a subject for another episode.
But it just sprung to mind while we were talking about it.
Yeah. So I think we're coming up on the Maw, and I've got to take the helm, and one of you guys have to do something with the sublight drives as we navigate around those gigantic black holes. So this is Sam signing off.
Christian, we'll see you later.
And this is Jordan. May the force be with y'all.
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
Thanks for flying with us. Jordan here. Just wanted to let everyone know what's happening here at the Star Lores podcast. Star Lores is now on Discord. If you would like to join the Star Lores Cantina Discord server, you can find a link in the description or on any of our social media accounts. Reach out with a DM or email. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching the Star Lores podcast. Go ahead and give our page a like and send us a message. You can also email at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your fan art, Star Wars collections, or fan fictions, and you may even get a feature on one of our pages or even the show. Don't be afraid to offer corrections or add to any of the topics that we discuss on the show. We are also on Patreon. So if you want to help us pay the bills, as well as get a few awesome perks like bonus episodes, access to the private Facebook group, or the VIP section of the Discord server, head on over to patreon.com/StarLores and sign up for as little as $1 a month. And finally, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher app or YouTube, as well as sending us a 5-star review on iTunes. This really helps us reach a wider audience. Enjoy the rest of the show.